Hey everybody, welcome back to Hot and Dry, a podcast about climate change and how it's affecting the places we live.
And how it's changing our lives. I'm Paige Buono.
And I'm Colin Haffey. All right, here's a quick question, just a really quick question. Did you have in your house a VHS cassette that you watched so many times that the front little flap fell off?
Mm-hmm.
And then you had to be extra careful kind of putting it in and out of the thing so that you didn't. And then you would not put it in the rewinder because that was too violent. So you'd rewind it in the VCR. Yeah. Which one was, what was that for you?
We had two. Well, and they were the only two films I think we had. But Fern Gully and Twister.
Oh, God. Such good answers. Oh, my God. Such good answers. Dude.
I know.
Holy crap. I can't remember the one for us. I think it was some cartoon. Dude, I would eat whatever it was though, wouldn't beat those two. Those are the only two movies that you have to, that explains so much. Oh my God. I love it. I loved those movies.
Those were great. They are still great movies.
They're transformative.
Yeah.
I swear to God, Twister is what made me want to be an environmental scientist. And Fern Gully was what got me out in the woods crying about trees.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome.
I think that all adds up.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh. We should have a movie marathon where we watch those
two
movies.
That sounds great. Just back to
and you know what I was thinking, what else I was talking to somebody yesterday and they mentioned, so there was that earthquake in the Jemez.
Oh yeah. Heard about
that. And you know, it was right on the edge of a volcano.
Mm-hmm.
So they mentioned we should watch Dante's Peak.
That's the other one I was going to mention. We also had Dante's Peak, but that one wasn't quite as destroyed.
It wasn't as watched.
Mm-mm.
Oh man, that should be the three film day.
Okay, it's like Lord of the Rings, but different.
but different, you know. Fern Gully, we can probably fast forward through.
Whatever. That's the one I'm most excited to watch.
Okay. Well, we can keep it there. But Dante's Peak, I think it will teach you how to respond to a volcanic eruption. So if that's sort of in our future.
Maybe we should. It's actually a precautionary measure at this point.
It's one of those things where, you know, like the Driver's Ed films. They're fun and educational.
Yeah, that's how I think about the Driver's Ed films. Not fun. Sign me up for all of them except for the Driver's Ed films.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think we can do a little movie trilogy.
That sounds great.
Outdoor. You know, there's a few other people I can think of who would really who could really be stoked on board with this.
That lineup.
Yeah.
Good. Because it's rare. Some people would roll their eyes and be disgusted at our current excitement. No.
Yeah. All right. Let's get back on track.
Okay.
Back on track. So the two things we wanted to talk about today are really fire and water. So wildfires and sort of the water crisis in many Western states, and really talk about how those things are linked. I think that a lot of things have made that, you know, a lot of things make the news almost every year, it seems like, in the West, at least. With, you know, major fires in some state, you know, and you see the big plumes and the planes kind of responding to the incident, and then some dam somewhere, some reservoir, you know, crossing some threshold, and you see the picture of the bathtub ring and things like that. So in New Mexico, it's always Elephant Butte. In other places like on the Colorado, it's Lake Mead, where you sort of do the before and after pictures of Hoover Dam, you know, chock full of water, versus now where it's all the people are kind of boating side by side and they have to go in kind of unison, and it looks sad, and it is sad. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about that. And so we've divided it up today. Paige is going to take the water piece, and I'm going to take a little bit of the fire piece. Why don't you go first, Paige, and talk about water, and then I can pick it up and talk about the intersections there with some fire.
I think you kind of hit on it, Colin, with the mention of the you know, what have become these iconic images of the West, including the bathtub rings. And I think, you know, what we're seeing this year just feels like more media attention on an issue that's been, you know, plaguing policy managers and researchers for decades. But I think it's sort of the mirror year where we don't get to talk about it as a future problem. You know, I think they, I was reading just yesterday, Luke Runyon with KUNC was sharing that the BOR, starting today, I think, is planning emergency releases from Flaming Gorge, Navajo, and Blue Mesa reservoirs to keep Powell from declining below that minimum level for hydropower production. And we're anticipating, I think, the first, you know, I think for the first time in history, the federal government is expected to declare an official shortage at Lake Mead. That's anticipated for August. And, you know, that has cascading effects that translate as the largest cutbacks to date for Arizona, Nevada, and Mexico. And I think these are all things that, you know, scientists like Jack Schmidt at the Center for Colorado River Studies and John Fleck here in New Mexico, Brad Udall, climate scientists, have all been warning about for decades. And we're sort of here facing it. And I think it's interesting to watch the media try to figure out how to handle it, how to talk about it.
I have two questions for you. One is, you know, when you read those articles, what's kind of your, after having read them for, or read similar articles for a long time, what is your gut reaction to these articles when you read them?
I think it's sort of immense frustration because I feel like this isn't a new alarm. And I think especially, I mean, what I can't imagine is being a John Fleck or a Jack Schmidt, or like a Laura Paskus, who has spent a huge chunk of their lives trying to sound these alarms, and just to see sort of the same messaging played out over and over again without real change, and the same sort of denial present both in the way things are written without explicitly linking to climate change, and then the way things are ignored or not responded to. So I tend to feel the same sort of like almost dizzying, like, haven't we had this conversation before? And, you know, a tiny bit of hope, I think, when you see sort of like maybe surprising, maybe unexpected people mentioned or at the table. It's like, oh, they've got, you know, ag producers on board, or, oh, they've got a Republican legislator who's interested in groundwater management, or, oh, but they kind of still feel small potatoes for how significant the challenge is.
And then sort of specifically, what happens when, you know, the federal water shortage declaration gets declared? I mean, I always think of like, every time I think about that, I always think about like Michael Scott standing up and declaring bankruptcy. I assume it's a little bit different than that. But what are the consequences of, you know, less on the process of actually how it happens and more on sort of what happens after it happens?
We'll have other people on who can speak more specifically, but it's cutbacks, and it's cutbacks, you know, probably most significantly to agriculture, who are the number one users on both the Rio Grande and the Colorado River. But I think it's, you know, it's cutbacks. We're seeing it already in recreation and industry. It's cutbacks in municipal use. And, you know, Nevada's saying people can't water their lawns after 2026. You know, I think it's changes to our lives. And I think probably most least spoken about is that the thing that's going to continue to be on the chopping block first is the river itself, and the ecosystem that it creates and the wildlife that rely on it. So I think that's, you know, that's what probably stands to lose most with our sort of continued denial of the realities of water.
We heard Gabe Vasquez talk about the push for a living river declaration, and so there are people fighting for the river, for sure. The river has voices, or has friendly voices, but you're right, it does seem to be kind of the one left holding the least amount of water at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, as is, and I'll be curious to hear if this translates for fire, but, you know, in the case of water, it's because we're tied to really archaic legal interpretations of water availability and, you know, and our delivery system so reflects that. And the river itself obviously didn't have a stake in those original negotiations. And so there's a big push. But as you said in the issue to Gabe, like, that's a big fight to pick because it's not just a fight in New Mexico. It's an international fight. And fighting that for the Colorado River is seven states and an international fight. And so, yeah, I think what's so interesting is, like, if we look at the science and we understand that climate change is going to change the availability of water, and we think about the natural ways that water can be stored on the landscape and, you know, kind of reimagine how we use our reservoirs, it feels like there's a real opportunity to have both of those values integrated. But man, it's going to be a massive paradigm shift in the way some really entrenched systems work.
So there was an article in the New York Times that I used one of my two free reads on, and it was about New Mexico and the response to drought. And it had a guy named Harold Trujillo from Ladue on, and he was, you know, talking about the drought impacts to his acequia and to his farming operation. And then also had Paulo Garcia and Tom Swetnam on talking about just kind of how bad it is and touching on some of the same things that you're talking about, Paige. And I think there's a quote in there from Tom Swetnam that says, you know, this is probably the second worst drought in 1200 years. And he posted that on Twitter, and a lot of people kind of came back, right? Because the internet is just memes now. But a lot of people kind of came back with that Simpsons meme of, you know, this is the worst, where Bart's like, this is the worst drought we've been in. And then Homer's like, oh, this is the worst drought so far, right? And it's just, the thing is that there's a directionality to all of these disturbances and to this drying. And, you know, we can talk about it in terms of droughts, and we should continue to talk about it in terms of droughts, but it's also just important to talk about it in a drying out. That's the whole, like, that's the hot and dry part of this, right? Like, that's the reason we're trying to communicate these things, is it's legitimately getting hotter, and it's legitimately getting, and because it's getting hotter, it's getting drier, which, you know, maybe a good way to segue into a conversation about fire.
Yeah, I was thinking exactly that, because I do feel like that's the link that's harder for us to make. I think people have kind of wrapped their head around, okay, hot, but drier means parched soils. Drier means water, even when we get it, is it making its way to the river at the same rate that it used to? And I know that that has a huge implications for fire. So yeah, I'd love to hear, you know, Colin, what are you reading about? What are you seeing?
There's a researcher, his name is Park Williams, and he used to work in New Mexico, but now he's over in New York at Columbia's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, which is really hard for me to say, apparently. And he summed it up, I think, perfectly in an article, again, in the New York Times, published a couple weeks ago, and we will post a lot of links in the show notes this time. But he said, you know, fire in some ways is a very simple thing. As long as stuff is dry enough and there's a spark, then that stuff will burn. And that's what we're seeing in places all the way from British Columbia to the west slope of Oregon and Washington and the Cascades, where, you know, those are essentially rainforests and people don't think about them as being flammable. But everything that's made of wood is flammable if it gets dry enough. And that's kind of what we're seeing. And in Park, has been working with a colleague whose name is John Abatsaglu, and John's been on the podcast before, but they published a paper back in 2016 that looked at, you know, tried to tease out this difference between climate change and how much of the wildfire are we seeing in the West is driven by climate change versus how much is driven by just sort of natural variability and fuel buildup and, you know, things like that. I mean, the West is a dry place. And so how much can we actually attribute to human caused climate change? And they found that a significant portion, I mean, without, you know, a quote from their thing is that the anthropogenic climate change will continue to chronically enhance the potential for Western U.S. fire activity when fuels are not limiting. So, I mean, that's a fancy way of saying what Park said. When there's things that are available to burn and it gets dry enough, it's going to burn. And climate change is pushing us, because of rising temperatures primarily, climate change is pushing us into that situation where more of the fuel out there, the trees and the grass and the shrubs and everything, are available to burn.
And can you talk about, I mean, what's the sort of, what's the what? What do we do with that? And what are sort of these articles, you know, are they landing in a doom and gloom place? Where's the attention now?
You know, sometimes these articles lay out the problems and then they kind of fall short on solutions. So if you look towards California, California is really focused on solutions, and they're a big state, you know, like the sixth largest economy in the world or whatever. And so they can put a lot of money into this. And, you know, they've also got a lot of indigenous communities who are working on solutions. They've got a lot of place-based groups that are working to try to solve some of these problems. And they've been majorly impacted by fire. And so they, you know, a couple years ago, they put together a bill that would supply $500 million of funding to wildfire protection and prevention and response. And an article came out just the other day that looked at, you know, California isn't actually spending that money in a way that it can, or in a way that it sort of promised. And it's not meeting its targets, and it's not meeting its sort of its goals that it's outlined with that funding. And to me, it shows that money isn't the only thing that's limiting. And we need, you know, we don't have the projects that are shovel ready. We don't have the groups on the ground that can absorb that kind of money and take it and do stuff with it. And so these are centuries long problems that have, you know, at least decades long to kind of get us out of it. And the challenge is, the longer that we wait, the more behind the curve we get to respond to these problems. So the solutions are really out there. It's just a matter of kind of getting that collective action together at a scale that we can respond that's equal to the challenge that we face.
And I'm curious, you know, on the water side of things, it feels like it's easy to say, you know, major action is needed now. And that's very true. But I think when you get in the weeds of what are those actions, who loses, who gets to decide who wins and loses, that's where the sort of real barrier is. Is that the same with fire? And how what are you seeing as ways to move that needle?
I think the difference between fire and water is, in terms of action, is from the water standpoint, you sort of start with scarcity and then you try to figure out how to allocate this resource that's becoming even more scarce. And so it's a huge challenge. But on the fire side, there's a lot of really good kind of co-benefits where you can go in and work to reduce the fire risk and create jobs and support healthy watersheds and build water quality and have habitat. And the challenge is really being focused, creating the areas where you want to work, getting in there, getting the work done, and then moving to the next place and being kind of systematic about it. It's not as challenging to conceptualize the win-win situation as it is in water. And I think that the solutions that we've been doing and that we've been working on are sort of the right solutions. And we just need to scale every single one of those up and put them all in the right place in the right order at the right time. That's a huge challenge, but it's one that actually has some kind of hope at the end of it. Whereas the water one, to me, and again, that's like, maybe it's because I'm outside of it so much, but I look at it and I just sort of shake my head and think, damn, what do we do? You know,
I agree. I mean, addressing scarcity from scarcity is a good way to put it, and a really immense challenge. I also feel like where there is a parallel with fire is sort of any continued denial about the direction that we're heading only makes that harder. Like, we aren't, by avoiding action, we aren't getting around the challenges of that. We're just ensuring that down the road, we're going to have less and less ability to respond. And probably there are going to be more and more losers, because as we continue to develop water that doesn't, it's paper water. I guess I would just say, like, I think if we listen to the science and we imagine new voices and integrate new voices, like the ecosystems and the rivers, and definitely like the tribes who have been left out in these negotiations for so long. It's possible that we just can't yet imagine what the solutions are that have the least number of losers.
Yeah, and I think the other thing I want to make sure everybody understands is that anytime you read one of these articles, it can feel like we've crossed the threshold, right? The thing that came out the other day in The Guardian about, oh, the Amazon is now emitting more carbon than it's sequestering. Those things feel like it's game over, right? And they feel really fatalist, but it's not, right? It's taking action now is better than waiting 10 years to take action. It doesn't, like, some thresholds are irreversible, but we can't let that discourage us from doing things, right? And like you're saying, if we can come together and we can find equitable solutions to these things, and yes, they're a challenge, but I guarantee you that it's not as challenging as it will be in 10 years. I guarantee that. So people call for drastic action all the time. And it's a common thing on social media. We need drastic action to solve the crisis. And I think let's take smart, measured action now and call it drastic. Because that would be drastic. If we were able to pull something together in the next 3 years that meant something, that was beyond just setting arbitrary goals for 10 years from now of X reduction, let's do something that matters at a level that impacts people who have been tied to the landscape for generations. Let's do something that matters at a scale that impacts people who live in communities and rely on healthy water and clean air. Do it now, and then we'll redo, and then we'll figure out, we'll learn from that, and we'll redo things, and we'll do more things 10 years from now.
Drastic action is just reimagining the trajectory. It's like doing the things that just start to move us away from the current path, because I think we're so entrenched in it that we can't imagine solutions outside of it, and we can't envision the alternatives because we're so stuck. So drastic action just feels like a halt on the way out of everything instead of, you know, intentional momentum in a new direction. And I think those small actions can help get us there and thinking more creatively at the right scales. It's cool, just really easy for us to sit over here and say all that, but I am so aware of how easy it is to say those things, but I think until we start sort of demanding that at all levels, we're gonna continue to sit stagnant.
I don't think you're just sitting there saying it. I think that these comments come from years of experience working to build strategic momentum towards change and towards a vision that isn't doom and gloom and doesn't require a complete reinvention of everything. And I don't want to assume that that means that we're in this like incrementalist centrist position. I think there's progressive and aggressive things that you can do in that model. Paige, you've been in these conversations. You've been driving the truck. You've been kicking Dorothy out of the bed so that you can get that tornado data.
Back to Twister. Put me in the truck. I'll release the things.
I still imagine myself like driving next to Helen Hunt down some roads in Iowa thinking like, damn, baby, let's go find a tornado.
Let's save the world. I'll use my belt to save you.
The whole movie was goofy, right?
Oh, yeah.
But like by the end of it, you were like, yes, they got their data.
Totally.
I know what that feeling is like when you finally get your data. And it's a beautiful feeling. It's a beautiful feeling. There hasn't been a movie like it. I don't know that there will ever be a movie like it. All right. Well, let's wrap up. And again, just trying out something new here and trying to pull some things together. There will be a ton of different links in the show notes. So please check that out as additional reading. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with an interview, kind of back to normal. Thanks so much, Paige. I really appreciate you doing this. And always enjoy our conversations.
Thanks. Same, Colin. Yeah, always learn a lot and appreciate the perspective shifts every single time.
Yeah, and if you do have something, you can email us at hotdrypodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at us. And yeah, just hope you're listening, hope you're thinking about things, hope you get engaged at some level, either with fire or water, both in your community.